This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force.
This is Episode 3, DNA and Blood Forensics.
You must be a world expert by now, because your writing career has spanned the introduction of DNA analysis. Do you remember when you first heard about this revolutionary new science?
Yes, it was opening TV series of Prime Suspect. And what a breakthrough when it came, because DNA analysis has changed crime writing more than anything else that you could. But you've got to have a bit of talent to kick it off. But man, has it changed crime writing.
Certainly, it changed police investigation in all crimes. But interestingly, at first, when it first came out, it was, his DNA's there. That's it, we've got him. His DNA's there. And then it began to, you know, it was, well, how, the question was, well, how did it get there? What's the interpretation around it? And it was actually, you know, no, you can't just sit back and rely on DNA alone, because it may have got there innocently, and you need to find more in your investigation and other forensics that give you enough evidence to put somebody before a court. For somebody like yourself, who's researched and learnt so much and worked with people who are experts in their field, do you think it must be hard for members of a jury to understand forensic science sometimes when it's been put across and the importance of it?
They do have a problem, but unfortunately, they're also, in this day and age, so aware that in every crime programme, in every... in every murder inquiry, the word DNA forensic is mentioned. And so you have a jury that are sitting there and often thinking, well, they should have got to that quicker. I mean, they had the DNA. Why haven't they? Because they are now all authorities on it. But the painstaking care of the scientist to prove without doubt their evidence is correct. They cannot make a mistake.
It's obvious through listening to you and having worked with you for over 20 years now, that you have a passion about getting it right and getting it right first time.
Yes. You know, I could not have written Prime Suspect without the assistance of a DCI that was in the Metropolitan Police, as I learned to listen intently to what she told me, virtually to obey, because she was completely free. She would look at a page and say, this is rubbish. I didn't get hurt. I didn't get worried. I'd say, how do I rectify it? She said, well, do it right. And I began to pick up that do it right. She would put me in incident rooms. She would put me at autopsies. And it was through her I learnt the word DNA, never before used on screen. And it was quite extraordinary to learn as I went on writing. And I will be forever grateful, because I knew I'd found the right way to gain respect from the people that helped me and to have respect for myself as well.
I think from my viewpoint, and certainly a lot of my ex-colleagues, they are drawn to your television shows and indeed your books, because it reflects the teamwork that goes in, that it's not just the scientist that solves the case, it's not just the detective or the CSI that solves it, it's actually doing it together, working out a plan on how you're going to deal with something and sharing information.
Police are interchangeable. Police can interchange with each other. But if information is not passed down the line, then it goes wrong. And I truthfully think the pressure they're under now is to make sure that doesn't happen.
I think it was in Bloodline. Didn't you use an unusual twist that I don't think any writer had used before, with DNA and familial DNA in an unborn child, a lady who was murdered who was pregnant?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is hard to believe that they can now do familial DNA. So they don't have the killer's DNA, but they can begin testing and they can have maybe a brother, a cousin, that far back. And over again, this has proved to be so beneficial and a link to the kill.
It's funny you should mention that, because Pete Smith, an old colleague who specialises in blood and DNA analysis, who spoke to me earlier at his lab, mentioned a similar story in the interview that we're about to listen to. I remember in my early days as a young detective in the 1980s getting involved in murder investigation. In those days, yeah, we'd have plenty of blood at a scene, we'd have cigarette ends, we'd have semen, all sorts of things like that. But really, it didn't help us much, because all we could do was to group the blood. But that could bring up loads of people who could be suspects. Then a couple of years later, DNA came along and totally revolutionised criminal investigation. I'm here today to meet an old friend and colleague who is a forensic scientist called Peter Smith. We work quite a few cases together, and he's an expert in DNA and forensic biology and blood patterns. So let's go meet him in his lab. Peter, good to see you again. How are you?
Hi, Chaz. Nice to see you again.
Makes a change from being at a crime scene, I guess.
No comment.
Peter, you've been a forensic biologist now for over 30 years. Just turning the clock back, how did you first get interested in it, and what was it like working scenes those many years ago?
I think I got into it partly because my father was a police officer, and I performed very well at an interview. That's the reason I got into it. And my company was willing to pay for my further education to obtain a degree, whilst I also gained experience as a forensic scientist. I am a forensic biologist. My fields of expertise include DNA profiling, blood pattern analysis, and the examination and analysis of body fluid stains.
From my knowledge, DNA didn't come into the forum until about the mid-1980s. So what did you do to put somebody at a crime scene before that?
Yeah, DNA was first developed by Dr. Alec Jeffries at Leicester University in 1985, first used in a criminal conviction in 1987, the first time. Before the advent of DNA profiling, we used blood grouping, which most people will recognise as ABO, rhesus blood grouping, and other enzymic blood groups present in the blood itself.
But that I would imagine, there would be so many people of particular blood groups, it didn't really evidentially help you that much.
Yeah, compared to the probability of obtaining matching profiles these days is, for example, for a full matching profile, is one in a billion. In the days of ABO blood grouping and the other blood groups, it used to be one in 52. So it was far, far less discriminating using the ABO blood group systems.
How does blood pattern analysis work?
The way I used to work a crime scene is I used to be called out by a police officer, or in those days a laboratory sergeant detective, and we'd attend the crime scene. And bearing in mind, sometimes the body was there, sometimes the body was not. Before you entered a crime scene, it was also imperative to put on your protective clothing to avoid contamination. And the second aspect that was most important was try to obtain as much information as possible that the police had about the crime scene before you actually entered the scene to examine the blood patterns. Once in there, the danger is to be too reactive and start saying this happened, that happened. I used to go in, have a look around for 20 minutes, half an hour, just have a think about the crime scene itself and what I knew about the victim's injuries, if I knew about those injuries. Then I would come out, and by the time I come out, the police might have more information, which helps me in my interpretation of the blood patterns. I then go back in, and I start taking photographs and taking notes of the blood patterns that I could see, of which there are many. There are many types of blood patterns. Blood patterns are split into two groups. One's called a spatter group and the other's called a non-spatter group. Now, spatter is defined as the airborne droplets of blood being projected through the air. So like a spray, if you like, most in the common terms. The non-spatter groups are things like contact stains, like a bloodied hand coming into contact with a tabletop, or a pool of blood resulting from bleeding out from an injury and surrounding the body. So there's spatter and non-spatter groups. If the person was had lacerations as a result of blunt force trauma, you may well see something called impact spatter, which is where an external blow is made into a source of wet blood, causing the blood to spatter onto clothing and onto walls and fixtures. There's things called arterial bleeding, for example, which is very characteristic. An arterial bleed is basically bleeding from a severed artery, and the blood pumps out under the pressure of the vascular system. And there's also patterns known as exhaled blood, which is where blood is coughed out through the mouth or sneezed out through the nose. So all these various blood patterns, and there are many more that I could mention, they all have certain characteristics that you need to try to identify to enable you to classify.
You mentioned a pathologist there, Pete. How were you able to work alongside the pathologist at the actual scene?
Well, a pathologist is the one with the medical training in terms of looking at injuries. So often, if I'm looking at blood patterns, then sometimes I need to have the injuries confirmed, and sometimes a pathologist will tell me the extent of bleeding from those wounds. So that all helps me in my interpretation of the patterns that I see. My sole objective, being a forensic biologist in analysing blood patterns, is to basically identify where the assaults have taken place, the events that comprise the assault, if I can, the sequence of those events, especially if it's a multi-room crime scene. My other responsibilities are to sample correctly, because obviously I have to take various samples from the crime scene for DNA profiling these days to establish who the blood is from. One of the big questions is it's often the unusual at many crime scenes that gives you the most important information. So it's not the blood patterns that are the easiest to interpret. But if the perpetrator or perpetrator has injured themselves, for example, in a frenzied stabbing, where their hand has slipped down onto the blade, they may well drip blood onto the floor. I'm not saying they do, but they may well drip blood onto the floor. So it's sampling those pertinent stains at crime scenes for DNA profile. That's one of our responsibilities.
Which that plays in as well then, obviously, with clothing. If, for example, the suspect has cut themselves and stood over the victim, did you have cases where you were able to examine clothing at the lab and say somebody must have been standing over the body and bleeding onto it?
Yeah, BPA takes two aspects. One is looking at BPA at crime scenes, and the other is looking at BPA on clothing. I would say that BPA at crime scenes is probably slightly the easier because you have the full picture. You can see everything. Whereas with BPA on clothing, there are two problems here. One is you only get what we call partial pattern capture because it depends on the orientation of the wearer in relation to what's going on. And the biggest problem, as most of the public are probably aware, is there's various types of fabrics out there. And once blood patterns fall onto fabrics, their appearance can become quite distorted, diluted, and that makes the interpretation quite difficult. So in my career of looking at blood patterns on clothing, I'm cautious. I never underestimate the evidence, but I never overestimate it. Finding blood is difficult. People assume just because it looks red, it's blood. Unfortunately, that's not the case. For us as forensic biologists to call a stain blood, it has to look like blood, and it has to give a positive reaction to a chemical test that we use called the KM or the LMG test. So if you get a positive for those two results, then you can call it blood. In terms of identifying it in the first place, your most important tools are your eyes. People don't use their eyes enough. You've got to observe before you comment. If the surface is difficult or it's dark or it's diluted, we can use a fibre optic light, which is a high-powered single beam of white light. Some people might know it as crime light now, which are handheld crime light torches. if the scene appears to have been cleaned up afterwards, then we can use something called luminal or blue star, which is basically a water-soluble reagent that you spray the surface with where you think the blood might be. And if blood is present, it will give you a yellow or blue chemiluminescence. There's some problems with this, though, is because it's water-soluble, it will dilute the blood stain and dilute the DNA. And secondly, it's very transient, which means it appears very quickly and then it disappears. So it's difficult to take any photography. And lastly, it cross-reacts with a lot of other substances other than blood that give a peroxidase activity. I'm not selling it very well.
Interesting, I had a case, Peter, where the suspect had actually cleaned the carpet and you couldn't see the blood, or to my eye, you couldn't see blood on top of it. But when we lifted the carpet underneath, he'd actually, by cleaning it, pushed it through, the victim's blood through to the underneath and to the underlay, which was quite helpful. Have you had cases yourself like that where you've they think they've cleaned, but they haven't?
Well, carpets is very interesting because a lot of the days now we have laminate floors, which the blood won't soak through, it will just rest on the top. But I think most people know blood's no different to coffee on carpets in that respect. When you change your carpet, where you've spilt coffee over the years, you pull it back and on the Hessian backing, there's more coffee on the underside than there is on the top side because it just soaks in. I think I had quite an interesting case down in Kent, I think it was, reminiscing again. This man was found, he'd been stabbed a number of times, had his throat cut lying by a glass table in the lounge. But he was initially sitting on a sofa, and he'd been hit with a full bottle, uncorked, of red wine. And there was red wine spattered all over the sofa and all over the walls. And this is no joke. Initially, it was so difficult to differentiate between what was blood on the walls and what was red wine. And the way we did that was, so it looked like blood, but the wine didn't give the positive test reaction for the test that we use. But it took a long time.
In this day and age, you cannot watch a crime thriller on TV or read a crime book without DNA coming up. And it obviously did change the face of criminal investigation and forensic science. What is your experience with DNA when it first started?
Oh, well, DNA's been invaluable in many ways. It's what we term, it's very good as an investigative tool. And what I mean by that is that it's very good at being able to identify suspects, identify victims, and link crime scenes together. But it's also an evidential tool. And what I mean by that is it's where the expert witness, such as myself or any other forensic practitioner, presents evidence in court and comments on the, for example, the probability of a match between a crime stain sample and maybe the suspect in the case or the defendant in the case. So it has an investigative use and an evidential use. With greater knowledge and advancing technologies, it's got far more sensitive and far more discriminating, which is obviously a very useful tool in forensic science.
When it first started, I believe you needed a blood sample about the size of a 10p piece.
Yeah, well, what we look for, using DNA, what we do is we analyse body fluids. So there's the major types of blood, semen, saliva, vaginal material, and the hair root sheath material from a plucked hair. Now, the amount of blood used in the very first case in 85 was about the size of a 50p piece. So you can imagine how much that is. And these days, you can get a DNA profile from a blood spot that you can only really see under a low-power microscope, so less than a millimetre in diameter. So the amount of material you used is much less, and it's far more sensitive. But because it's so sensitive, it also has some issues in interpretation.
And what about mixtures? If you end up with mixtures of blood, can you determine whose is whose with those?
Yeah, I mean, I in some cases, if you're looking at a crime stain sample and you're comparing it with a reference sample, like a mouth swab from a named individual, if you get a full profile, it's fairly easy to compare. But unfortunately these days, because it's got so sensitive, you get a higher number of what we call DNA mixtures. And what I mean by a DNA mixture is the presence of DNA from more than one person. So it could be two people, it could be at least three, it could be at least four. Obviously, the more complex the mixture becomes, the robustness of one's interpretation can be brought into question. so the discriminating power maybe is less.
You mentioned discriminating power. I mean, like they say, people think that DNA is conclusive. If his DNA is there, he or she must have done it. But is DNA conclusive?
Is DNA conclusive? I think maybe to a jury it's conclusive. There's a number of issues. If you get a full matching profile to a suspect in a case, the way it is reported by forensic scientists, and this is the way it's spoken out in court, is the probability of obtaining a matching profile, if the DNA came from someone other than and unrelated to the suspect, is 1 in a billion. Now, the wording is very careful because the lawyers usually come back and say, so the chance of it coming from someone else is 1 in a billion. And if you listen to what the counsel is saying, they're assuming the person is guilty. We're not saying that. We're commenting on the probability of a chance match in a population of 1 in a billion. But to a jury, as soon as they hear 1 in a billion and it matches maybe the defendant in the dock, some of them may, I've got no justification for this, but some of them may just switch off and say, he's guilty or she's guilty. Because of the probative value is so overpowering of a matching full matching DNA profile, often people will admit that the DNA is from then, but the question then becomes how and when was that DNA deposited? And that requires a completely different skill set.
In respect of that, then, I could shake somebody's hand, they leave, I get a knife and stab somebody and leave it there, and my DNA may not be there, but the person whose hand I shook could be on the murder weapon.
There is that possibility, and that has to be argued out at court. I think with this, what they call touch DNA now, that's the phrase they tend to use, so we're not talking about a known body fluid, but a touch DNA from shaking hands, the chances of obtaining a full matching profile are probably a lot lower, so you tend to get a partial DNA match. So what I mean by partial DNA match is you're not getting all the DNA components you're looking for in your result, you just get a few of them. So if you can imagine that, the discriminating power is much lower, so the probative value is much lower.
What about a case where you have a family and there's, say, 2 or 3 brothers and a member of that family is a suspect? Will those brothers have the same DNA?
If they're not identical twins, if any of them, then they won't have the same DNA. But what they will have is that they will have a high degree of relatedness to their other brothers. So they will share a high number of the DNA factors that we're looking for. A common defence is, it wasn't me, it was my brother. Right? So if that's the defence, that figure of 1 in a billion, believe it or not, reduces to 1 in 10,000, which is quite significant as a defence. But history has it, and my understanding now is that when the judge hears that, he says, get a blood sample from the other brother and see whether it matches. And they're quite demanding on that aspect now. So what happens is they go and get a blood sample or a reference sample from the brother who's supposed to have done it, and they get a DNA profile and they find that it doesn't match. Because there will be a high degree of similarity, but there will be areas that don't match.
I've had cases where we did find some DNA and then we've run it, but they've not come up on the database. What else, other tests could you do on that to try and find a suspect?
Well, we have something in the country since 1995 called the DNA database for England and Wales. And on that database there now sits a high number of DNA profiles from named individuals and victims and also unknown crime scene stains. So what happens is if you have a murder scene, and I've had one example, if you have a murder scene where you have a crime stain that doesn't match the victim or the victims in the case and doesn't match any of the nominated suspects in the case, then it's classified as an unknown profile. What we can do, if the police want to do it, is that they can search the National DNA database with the unknown full profile. And what happens is they're searching the database for profiles with a high degree of relatedness to that crime stain profile, which would suggest, if they get some, that maybe a relative, male or female at this stage, could possibly be related to the crime stain. And what happens is, this is called familial searching, which is fairly self-explanatory. And what the output is from a familial search is a list of not suspects, but we call them candidate profiles, possible people who could be related to the person who left the crime stain.
One of the biggest risks at crime scene has got to be cross-contamination. Were you trained in how to avoid it or train others, police officers? And
yeah, I mean, at crime scenes, this is quite interesting. My very first crime scene was back in the early 80s, a murdered prostitute in Islington. And in those days, the approach by the detective in charge was slightly different than the approach taken now. This senior investigating officer turned up. I just about got a pair of gloves on him. And he came in the crime scene smoking a cigarette. Yeah, and he looked around and said, yeah, OK, yeah, yeah, and he walked out. Now, these days, the scene is all cordoned off. Nobody's allowed to enter or leave the scene unless they've got full protective clothing on. And by that, I mean all-in-one white suits that you've seen on the television, overshoes, double gloves, face mask and hood up. But within the scene, sampling techniques have improved so you don't contaminate. What sort of training did you receive in all those in those days gone by?
Well, when I first joined the police, there was literally no training at all in forensics or about crime scene awareness. In fact, my first Christmas, I was told to go down and sit in a living room with a guy who'd been stabbed by one of his sons during two sons arguing, and Dad stepped in to say, stop it, lads, as one went to stab the other, and unfortunately Dad straight in the heart. And I just had to sit in this room and wait with this body there till the CID came. Well, of course, because it was Christmas Day, they couldn't get anybody. And eventually they did. Somebody did come out. But that's just the way it was. And then years later, it wasn't until I went on an exhibits course, then became a CSI, that actually, you know, was taught more about being forensically aware. But even doing the job itself, there was no update training. If you wanted to know, you had to go out there and find out for yourself. And joining the Forensic Science, or Chartered Societies is now, Forensic Sciences, opened up a new world for me. And it led me to, you know, meet people who do similar roles to you, learn about entomology, and I'd have an SIO say, well, what about this? I said, well, I don't know, Governor, but I know somebody who does.
But there's one thing that we both have used, which still needs to be used today, but I think needs to be used more. You can have all the training and all the ologies in the world, but the one thing you need in forensic investigation is common sense.
Common sense, yeah. What about the future of DNA? Where do you see it going?
Well, the work currently ongoing, I think it's at some London universities and also globally, they're trying to progress something called DNA phenotyping, which is somewhat different to what we do now. And what that is, they're trying to establish whether they can attempt to identify the hair colour of an individual, the eye colour of an individual, and also the ethnicity of that person from those aforesaid parameters. It's very much an investigative tool rather than an evidential tool, and I think it's classified as work in progress.
Peter, we could talk about this for hours. But this has been fascinating, and I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure that all our listeners will as well. And thank you very much for coming and meeting me today.
Thank you, Jess.
I'm fascinated by the way that DNA is presented in court and the way that the jury reacts to this sort of scientific evidence. But the reality is, it isn't quite as simple as that, is it, Cass?
That's correct. They actually call it the CSI effect upon juries, because the people who watch television shows and believe what they see on television. But again, it's as Pete alluded to when I spoke to him, he said it's about the interpretation of the evidence. And he said in particular with DNA, the statistics about one in a billion. He said, and the science behind it can be very complex and hard for a jury to understand. And again, he also said that DNA, it is not conclusive evidence because it is one in a billion, because there could be one other person out there with the same DNA, which is quite amazing when you think about it, really, because fingerprints are taken as a given. If your print's there, that's it. It's there. It can't be anybody else's. In his interview, Peter alluded to LMG and Blue Star, which are very similar to Luminol. But one of the things for me is that other things like bleach will fluoresce when luminol's put on it, and you can only test certain areas of what you think is the blood. But to a jury, when we were speaking about juries earlier, I kind of wonder, seeing this bath all sort of glowing, and a lot of it could be bleached, does that make the person sitting in the jury think, oh my God, look at all that blood in that bath, when it's not necessarily all human blood?
It's been such a long journey for me from my earliest days learning about blood analysis and grouping to now researching the fast-moving forensics of DNA analysis. I have to keep on top of everything. But beneath it, you cannot say that DNA can solve the case. It will be presented as scientific evidence towards the culmination and finish of a case, but it cannot rest on that alone. There still has to be detailed policing and detailed investigation, but now they are combined, and hopefully perpetrators are being caught far faster than ever before.
What's great, though, in the Young Tennyson series of books that you've done is that you actually take the reader back in time. And with some forensic sciences like blood pattern, fibres, for example, paint, mechanical fits that you use, they're all still existing today and have existed, you know, for many, many, many years. So it's interesting that, yes, there is the new, but sometimes the old can actually help solve a crime as well. They are the sort of old ways.
Yes, Moriarty.
Interestingly, I don't know if you were aware, but as an honorary fellow of the Chartered Society of Forensic Sciences, you now sit alongside Sir Alec Jeffreys, who discovered the use of DNA in forensic investigation. But you also sit alongside me as well.
Ooh, what an honour! Well, everyone, that's it for this episode. Episode 4, Entomology, the study of insects and their relationships to humans, will be out next week.
Flies are curious things, so they land on us the whole time. They're irritating things. When we're alive, we can brush them off. But obviously, when we die, we can't do that, and they'll go on and investigate you. And of course, as we decompose quite rapidly after death, we begin to smell. And the flies are much better able to detect those odours than we are.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnie A. Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.